Good morning. It's Monday, August 25th. I'm Shamita Basu. This is Apple News Today. On today's show, federal cuts have left many health agencies stretching to perform basic functions. How a strict abortion law has changed what it's like to be pregnant in Texas. And a new Little League World Series champion is crowned. But first, in a new phase of President Trump's crackdown on Washington, D.C., some National Guard troops patrolling the city began carrying firearms last night. It's been 2 weeks since Trump declared a crime emergency in D.C. and used that as justification for federalizing the city's police force and sending in National Guard troops. Some of those troops are now reportedly in areas like the city's National Mall, among the safest and most tourist-friendly sites. CNN reports that overall, there has been a drop in crime in Washington since Trump's takeover. According to police data, in the first week of federal forces in D.C., property crime was down about 19% compared to the week before, while violent crime dropped roughly 17%. The numbers for things like theft, burglary, and car break-ins, however, vary widely. There are some indications that the increased militarized presence is beginning to have an effect on the local economy, with restaurant visits and store foot traffic down compared to data from a year ago. At the same time, The Washington Post reports that federal law enforcement is increasingly taking a new approach of having ICE agents accompany D.C. police officers to make arrests. Jenny Gathright is a reporter for The Washington Post who covers D.C. politics and government.
A big change in D.C. and probably the most visible and most felt by residents has been this increased immigration enforcement from ICE. A significant portion of the arrests that the White House is touting as a result of this have been immigration-related.
That has included instances of delivery drivers on mopeds being detained by ICE. The Post reports that local police have been trying to enforce traffic laws for mopeds, but now with ICE officials riding along, a number of these arrests have resulted in drivers, many from Central and South America, being detained.
Those are some of the most visible, you know, in commercial corridors, arrests that go viral on social media of ICE detaining delivery drivers who routinely are all over the city on mopeds delivering food.
The White House says there have been more than 300 arrests of people in D.C. who do not have legal immigration status. That's a tenfold increase over typical ICE arrest numbers in the area, according to a review of government data by CNN. And the administration claims many have been arrested for additional crimes, but Gathright says so far they haven't provided evidence to verify that. D.C.'s attorney general had filed a lawsuit challenging Attorney General Pam Bondi's order to ignore sanctuary city laws in the Capitol. In a hearing last week, the judge in the case seemed to suggest that Trump likely has the authority to order police to assist ICE.
I think that this legal battle is what we're going to be keeping a close eye on this week to see what a judge decides, especially because this is an untested law. This is a provision of the Home Rule Act that grants the city limited self-governance that Trump is invoking to exert this authority over the city, but it's never been done before. And so I think the question about how far the Trump administration can take this is something that's moved to the courts and is going to be fascinating and very intense to watch.
Roughly 8 in 10 D.C. residents oppose Trump's police takeover and the deployment of National Guard troops to the city, according to a Washington Post Schar School poll. In a statement last week, a spokesperson for DHS said agents are working to reestablish law and order and, quote, President Trump was clear he will make D.C. safe and beautiful again. D.C. officials have noted violent crime in the city before Trump's actions were at a 30-year low. Let's turn now to public health. Last week, the Supreme Court allowed the Trump administration to, for now, move ahead with canceling close to $800 million in grants from the National Institutes of Health that it claimed were earmarked for topics that do not align with the administration's values. These grants affect a wide array of projects like research on HIV, cancer, the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic, and more. And they're just one part of massive cuts to federal health spending the administration has made this year. ProPublica recently took stock of how the workforce across all federal health agencies has been impacted by analyzing public information from the HHS staff directory. Reporter Annie Waldman told us the administration went much further than it initially promised.
They really said that these cuts were going to be focused on paring down the federal government and getting rid of, in their words, administrative bloat. We have revealed that these cuts are not trimming the fat of the federal government, but it's really cutting into the vital muscle of our health agencies.
ProPublica found a little more than 20,000 workers have either left or been pushed out of federal health agencies this year. That's about 18% of the total workforce.
This includes scientists, public health specialists, clinicians, consumer safety specialists, product investigators, cancer and HIV specialists, and vaccine and chronic disease experts.
The net result, ProPublica reports, is a number of departments stretching to perform their basic work. Some food and drug inspectors have had to buy their own supplies to sweep for pathogens. Some labs have been unable to purchase mice for vaccine tests. And this tally does not include workers who have received layoff notices but remain on administrative leave. So Waldman says the true total is higher. The NIH was hit particularly hard, losing 16% of its staff, and the FDA, which lost at least 21% of its workforce.
And more than a third of these workers that were cut were at their Office of Inspections and Investigations, which serves as the eyes and ears of the agency. That means there are going to be fewer people that are looking at Americans' food, drugs, and medical devices.
The CDC's Chronic Disease Center lost about 20% of staff, nearly half of whom were scientists and public health workers. Waldman says that's meant some divisions, like the office that tracks tobacco use and supports state-level programs to prevent smoking, have been effectively eliminated.
I've been told by multiple people that there is only one employee left working in the office. And so, you know, what this means is that even though RFK Jr. is on his bully pulpit saying that he is going to end chronic disease in America, he is taking away the very people who are experts at this.
ProPublica interviewed more than three dozen former and current federal employees for this story, and they told Waldman there are ways to find efficiencies in their work, as the administration wants to do.
But most people told me that this is not the way to do it. You need to go in and actually see which programs are working and support those programs, and then try to find the inefficiencies to phase those out. But what's happening right now is that full-scale departments, divisions are just being hit hard with these cuts.
A spokesperson for HHS told ProPublica cuts were made to reduce bloated bureaucracies, and they're working to redirect resources to science that rebuilds public trust and helps make America healthy again. The agency did not dispute any of ProPublica's findings. Let's turn now to Texas, where a year-long investigation from the Dallas Morning News reveals how state abortion laws have changed the landscape of healthcare for providers and patients. Texas has one of the most restrictive abortion bans in the country. Abortion is illegal except in cases where a patient's life or major bodily functions are at risk. Doctors who are convicted of providing an illegal abortion can lose their medical license, face prison time, and be subject to larger fines. To date, no physicians have been convicted for performing an abortion in the state since the Dobbs decision. The Dallas Morning News spoke with nearly 50 current and former physicians who say Texas abortion laws are so vague that they're unable to provide the treatment they would typically recommend based on best practices and medical training. They see abortion as a necessary standard of care, but say Texas has created a culture of fear that's jeopardizing their patients' lives. Here's how Dr. Shanna Combs, an OBGYN in Fort Worth, described it to the Dallas Morning News.
What we're seeing is women ending up getting severe infections, getting septic, admitted to the ICU, needing massive blood transfusions, losing their uterus, all these complications that can lead to significant morbidity and unfortunately mortality for patients.
Some institutions have taken these decisions out of doctors' hands, creating committees to review and approve cases where abortion can be provided. In other cases, hospitals are instructing physicians to use their best judgment when deciding if abortion is necessary and legal. Doctors and legal experts say that puts them in a vulnerable position, given the lack of clarity around Texas's laws. Here's how Tommy Hastings, a medical malpractice attorney in Houston, put it.
A very dear friend of mine who's a physician said, every time I treat a patient, I have to think, am I going to risk this mother's life, or do I have to risk my children not having their mother at home? Because some zealot has decided to come after me to make a point.
The Texas State Medical Board did revise some of its guidance for doctors, but did not specifically list exceptions to the abortion law. Under these restrictions, doctors told the Dallas Morning News they've changed how they counsel their patients, sometimes withholding information or talking in code, especially when they want to recommend a patient seek care out of state. Dr. Austin Denard, an OBGYN from Dallas, said it's distressing for patients to consider leaving Texas for care, and she would know. She's had to do it herself.
It's traumatic to flee the state to go get essential medical care. Even when you have the means and the privilege to get on an airplane, to go get the care that you need to save your life or to save your future fertility, that's traumatic enough. And I don't think that that's discussed enough publicly about what that really feels like. But practicing every single day in the state sometimes feels as traumatic as having to go flee myself.
Physicians told the Dallas Morning News that their patients are increasingly questioning if it's safe to be pregnant at all in Texas. The medical research from recent years shows health outcomes are getting worse for mothers and babies. Rates of serious complications like sepsis in the state have climbed, so have maternal and infant mortality rates. Before we let you go, a few other stories we're following. For the first time, the world's leading authority on food crises declared on Friday that a man-made famine was occurring in Gaza City. This follows months of warnings from aid groups that Israel's restrictions on food and other aid in Gaza, as well as the military strikes, were leading to starvation, particularly among Palestinian children. Israel has repeatedly denied that people are starving in the Gaza Strip. UNICEF Executive Director Catherine Russell spoke to CBS's Face the Nation about the horrific conditions.
Children literally waste away, and you see it in rooms where, you know, suddenly they're all quiet. The children are so quiet because they have no energy even to cry. And to see that happen, and especially in a place where food is not very far away, right? There's no reason. This did not happen because there were cyclones or, you know, droughts. This happened because we could not get enough aid into these children.
Vox reports that official famine classifications are exceedingly rare. Advocates say that while the distinction doesn't change the conditions on the ground, it can draw more attention and political action. In immigration news, Kilmar Abrego-Garcia, the man who was wrongfully deported to El Salvador earlier this year before being returned to the United States, has been detained again today when he showed up for an immigration check-in in Baltimore, just 3 days after he was freed from custody. Over the weekend, the Trump administration promised to send him to Costa Rica if he agreed to plead guilty to human smuggling charges and to serve whatever prison sentence he eventually received. Otherwise, they threatened to send him to Uganda. His lawyers accused the administration of trying to coerce a guilty plea from him and have said he's expressed willingness to leave the United States and accept refugee status in Costa Rica. And finally, the Little League World Series concluded yesterday with a big win for Chinese Taipei. The team beat American champs Nevada 7-0, thanks in part to a dominating pitching performance by ace Lin Chin-saw. Yesterday's game draws to a close a series that featured some early drama, notably a bat-flipping scandal that involved lawsuits and a sign-stealing debacle that caused chaos on the field. This is a record 18th title for Chinese Taipei and its first Little League World Series win since 1996. They also broke a 6-year win streak by American teams. You can find all these stories and more in the Apple News app. And if you're already listening in the news app right now, we've got a narrated article coming up next. Vanity Fair tells the story of William Noguera, a man who spent 40 years on death row and while there helped take down one of America's most notorious serial killers. If you're listening in the podcast app, follow Apple News Plus Narrated to find that story. And I'll be back with the news tomorrow.